The following Dharma talk was recorded in May 2013 in St. Louis, Missouri. It is one of five recordings from the retreat called Upadana, the Buddha's Teaching on Attachment, taught by Gloria Terania Ambrosia. The retreat was sponsored by Mid-America Dharma. If you like this recording, you can find more talks at www.midamericadharma.org. For questions, we welcome your emails sent to info@midamericadharma.org. The retreat teacher, Gloria Terania Ambrosia, is a student of the Western Forest Sangha and a lay Buddhist minister in association with Abhayagiri Buddhist Monastery in California. She serves as a core faculty member at the Berry Center for Buddhist Studies and has been a Dharma teacher since 1990. More information on Terania can be found at www.bcbsdharma.org.
So we have this one more session together to think about, look at, examine the Dhamma, the teachings that particularly apply to attachment. And, I hope I've been conveying a sense how the meditation practice itself ties so much into our capacity to non-attach. That's really what it's all about. See the body as the body and leave it at that. See feeling as feeling and leave it at that. And now see mental states as mental states and leave it at that. And I just want to say a little bit about that, and then certainly we can open it up if you have some lingering comments or questions. But what the Buddha is pointing to in the third foundation of mindfulness is the fact that mental states arise in the mind. And it's kind of fascinating to contemplate the mechanism for that. I don't really understand it in terms of the biology or the neurology. There's all kinds of little synapses firing and memories are being triggered and states are arising. But the Buddha describes it in terms of karma, that there are habitual patterns and habits. There's lots of different names for these. Sankaras is the Pali word for it. But they're just highly conditioned, highly habitual states. And we each have our own little cluster and constellation of these, don't we? I mean, you know yours, I know mine. And they arise seemingly unprovoked at times, and then you have to endure the state. If you're, as a meditator, you try to sort of ride it out. If we're not able to see it, if we're not awake, then we relate to it usually in one of three ways. We indulge it. We get lost in it. We hate it. We resist it. Or we don't see it, which is the first. So, the Buddha is trying to help us to overcome those deluded ways of seeing it. Those ways of seeing it that not only deluded, but they're what constitutes our suffering. The suffering is not in the state. The suffering is in the fact that we, how we react to it, how we relate to it. And so, it's very fascinating just to contemplate the language that he uses in this section of the sutta, where this is all from the foundations of mindfulness, where he says, one understands or one knows, one sees a mind affected by greed, hatred, delusion, non-greed, non-hatred, non-delusion, as such, as a mind affected by that. And just that language, I think, is really interesting because on several counts, really, he's pointing to, first of all, he goes through this litany of this state and its opposite, this state and its opposite, greed, non-greed, hatred, non-hatred, delusion, non-delusion, and he also makes a distinction, doesn't make a distinction, he's just running through the litany of sort of more mundane states and very exalted states, jhanic states, very high, powers of mind states. And basically the subtext in it, the way he's presenting it, is to see them all the same. And that's not our usual mode. That we tend to crumble or resist difficult states and feel inflated by our skillful states. And so he's, I think the implication in the way he's offering the guidance is don't do that. Just try the cultivation of mindfulness of mental states is to endeavor to see them all the same. So that speaks to a quality of heart that if you can feel it, it doesn't have a whole lot to do with the state. The state is irrelevant at one level. What's important is that we develop a capacity to be equanimous in the presence of mental phenomenon. That takes some time to get a sense of to get a sense even because it defies reason. It defies our habit. Our habit is when it's unpleasant, get rid of it. When it's pleasant, indulge it. And so this we do this with mental states as well. And so he's trying to carry that instruction to break that habit even to something as seemingly personal as our own mental phenomenon. And I think that this is interesting because it does also speak to the fact that we're much more identified with what's going on with the mind than what's going on with the body. You know, you can sort of get some space from physical sensations or, you know, being tired. You can get a little space from that or being energetic, but to feel, to have a mood or a mind state arise and seemingly overtake us. The idea that, that doesn't have to happen is like, whoa, you're kidding me. You know, I didn't know that. We're so identified. This is who I am. How can that be? But this is what he's saying. So the first thing is to really develop the capacity to see the whole range of moods and mind states, the whole continuum, with the same quality of heart. So again, it speaks to mindfulness, it speaks to being relaxed, and it speaks to non-judgment, right? Goes back to those basics again. So that's one layer of it. Another thing is that, the language that he uses, he says this, to know the mind affected by this state. So that seems to suggest or imply, and this is all to be tested and look and see. Don't believe it. Look and see that any state that arises in the mind is not the natural state of the mind. You know, Ajahn Chah used to call the whole range, skillful and unskillful, visitors to the mind, and that there's a constant arising and passing in a way through the field of the mind. And, pulls the different states in or pulls different, you know, or doesn't, just lets them move through. And so this is interesting too, that, you know, it seems to be suggesting that, I want to avoid the language of like an intrinsic nature because I don't think the Buddha quite goes there, but it does seem to suggest that there's some kind of, knowing that is in a way not the state. You know, it's still the mind, but it's not the state. And resting in that is a much more, free and open-hearted, proposition. So that's important to contemplate too and look and see if indeed this is true. And so the thing that you learn as you're practicing with this, practicing with non-attachment to mental states, is that I think it's just very helpful to know that some of them are very deeply entrenched and much harder to see than others. And I'm sure you've seen this in your practice. You know, the language of identity is apt, I think. You know, we're identified. When it comes up, you don't have any space. You don't have any capacity to see it because it's real in a way. The language the Buddha used is you become it. You get completely caught up in it. And so some are very, very hard to see. And some are a lot easier to see. And so just, I don't know, I find it reassuring to know that, you know, it's going to take some time with some of these states. And also to know that, you know, there's, it's not like, you know, I can or cannot see a state. You have to look at that in time, and take into account what's going on now, because that may be affecting my capacity. So say when you're on retreat, this is one of the values of retreat, you build up a momentum of looking. And so your capacity to see increases, you know. But it may not. I'm not saying it does, you know, necessarily. But different things that are going on in your body, in your mind, will affect your capacity to see at any given moment. And so you have to take that into account, too. This is all by way of encouraging a certain kindness towards ourselves and open-heartedness. We have to constantly be taking in the whole picture. You know, like, I don't know about you, but if I'm tired and hungry, you know, moods and mind states will just take me over, you know. I'm pissed off, you know. if you're attached to certain views, then, they're going to overtake you a lot easier. So it's conditions of the body and mind, but some of those conditions include the attachments. So, like, just as a silly example, one that comes to mind is if you think that when you're getting onto the highway and you're in the merge lane, that people should wait for you to merge, you know, that's the way it's done, then you're going to suffer. Or that people should have their checks ready when they're going through the supermarket line, you know, then you're going to suffer. I mean, these are views, these are ideas, and they will affect the way that your capacity to stand back from your own reactive patterns. Yeah. Or if you're constipated. I can remember visiting a friend years ago, and, you know, her husband was just really in a nasty mood, you know, and he kept criticizing me and criticizing her and saying this and this and this. I said, "What's with him?" You know, she said, "Don't worry about him. He's constipated." But it's true, isn't it? I mean, it's going to affect you. So just, you know, knowing this can be very, very helpful. You know, we have to just contemplate and reflect on, even before you try to look at moods and mind states, on what all is going on in your, in their arising and in your capacity to see them. And then, of course, by all means, pay attention to what happens when you see them. You know, because what the Buddha points to here is that you will see, if you're back far enough and not attached and have developed that equanimous attitude towards them, you will see their arising and passing nature. You will see that if you grasp them, you are the one who is suffering. You will see that you don't have the control that you think you have, that these mind states are not, they're your karma. In that sense, they're yours. But in the moment that they arise, they are not you. And that's, I'm not playing with words there. You know, just to contemplate that and see it. You know, he says over and over again in a number of suttas, do not relate to these from the vantage point of me. I, mine, myself. Like, lose that orientation towards the body and the mind. And that's what he's talking about when he's talking about eradication of self-view. It's losing that view to, mental and physical phenomenon. And so, you know, this whole teaching of non-self, it can sound really weird, but that's all he's saying. It's not weird at all. It's brilliant. It's a brilliant insight and realization, and very, very helpful to us as we're trying to find some semblance of peace in our lives. So, mindfulness of body, mindfulness of feeling, mindfulness of mind. Really working with those in this way. Relax. pay attention, be equanimous. Relax, pay attention, be equanimous. You know, that's the ticket. And yeah, it's a long time coming, but, that doesn't speak to any, fault or problem on our part. It speaks to, the nature of karma and the strength of these, of habit. Okay? So that's a lot. I mean, we've covered a lot of ground, but it's hopefully you find it a helpful teaching. And I suspect that you probably have some comments or questions about the things we've been talking about. Let's take a little time and tie up loose ends. Yeah. Yeah, it all comes down to how, not what you do, but how you do it. The quality of heart with which you act. So to see these moral transgressions, or sometimes on a societal level, you know, to see them happening and to feel the pain of the harm that's being done. This is all very, very important. And it's not like it's an attachment to feel that pain or a view. Like a wrong view to say this is wrong. You know what I mean? You do want to be able to see that. And it is a view in one sense. I like to think of it more as it's like a knowing. It's an observation. It's a realization. When you touch the truth of dukkha, you know, then, you know harm and you know it when you're face to face with it and nose to nose and toes to toes with that. So the Buddha in the teaching on dukkha, for example, he's not saying life has these things in it, so shut up and bear it, you know. He's saying just to recognize it, to feel the harm, to open to and feel the harm, and it doesn't preclude in any way acting to eradicate that. It doesn't say you can't do that. All he's saying is go to the place where you feel the harm first. Go there, and then your actions are going to come out of, much more likely to come out of wisdom and compassion than out of aversion. You know, and you can see this. I mean, in certain kind of people working on different issues on the planet, you know, I mean, I'm certainly not judging them because I think but a lot of people will be working from the place, this shouldn't be happening. People shouldn't behave this way. And I think the Buddha would say, but they do. They do. And you have to keep bringing your heart back to that so that you act from that. That's wisdom. That's knowledge. It's like you accept, but it's not like you don't do something about it. You accept the reality of it. You accept the reality of ignorance and delusion. I'm not sure what you mean. Yes, yes. It's more a rising up. The attachment would be if you felt this shouldn't happen. You're attaching to a view that this shouldn't happen. If you've gotten under that and touched the reality that it is happening, then what moves in the heart is compassion and understanding. Like where insight into dukkha is really important for these kinds of concerns on the planet, because it gives rise to the only response that really makes sense. You know, what are you going to do? You're going to go to war with people who do it? This is stupid. But we do it over and over again, you know. I'm not saying it sounds simple to say it, but then these at a political or economic level, these things get very complicated, don't they? Oh wow! Oh yeah! Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, it makes a lot of sense. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Exactly. I mean, we see it all over, don't we? Mm. Well, you have to cut through the the bit that any shoulds and shouldn'ts, that's where the view comes in. And once you can do that, then you're with the reality of the way that it actually is. And I'm not saying this is easy, but opening to the truth of dukkha, opening to the enormity of the harm that human beings do to one another and to other sentient beings is not fun, but it's what the Buddha is inviting us to realize, to really actually let that into the heart. This is not, you can idealize a heavenly state, you can idealize a utopia on the planet, but the reality of it is, because of the persistence of delusion, that is not, doesn't seem to be what the human experience is about, at least not at this stage of our evolution. And so to the extent that I can just know that, then, and bring all of that understanding to the harm of the racism or the harm of the unequal treatment of women and all of that, and know it. I understand this is all because people don't get it, because they don't understand the way that life is, the characteristics of life. Then if you can feel that, it sort of cuts through the investment in making it be some other way, and it acknowledges the impact that delusion has on the mind and the consequences of all of that. And it also, in some ways, I think you take into account just from seeing yourself and how difficult it is to change these patterns. Now you take that to a societal level, you know, you're talking some major transformations of mind that have to happen before people stop doing these things, right? And so you take into account the time that it will take. And you can do the same work, but you do it with a lot more patience. You do it with a lot more understanding. You do it with a lot more equanimity. But you still do the work if you're inspired to do it. But another side of it too, which I think we have to acknowledge, is that not everybody is inspired to do that. Not everybody. And so we have to take into account that somebody else's, it's not that they're not concerned. It's that their makeup is such that they're doing something else. And so take that into account too. It's big stuff. I mean, these are big issues, aren't they? It's big stuff, and sorting it out for ourselves individually. How do you, if you're moved to address some of these big issues on the planet, how are you going to do it? The quality of heart with which you do it. Yeah. It's, yeah. This is hard. Yeah.
And I'm not going to back off from here.
That's right. Yeah. Right. Right. That's great. Thank you. And what immediately came to mind when you were talking was Gandhi, you know, because, I mean, basically that's what he did. He said, no, we're not going to participate in this. This is harmful and hurtful. And you being in our country is creating a lot of suffering. You're going to have to go. You know, and they did. I mean, not without some struggle, but they did. They're like, what? Unheard of, really. That's right. And he's seen the worst of it. So, I mean, these people are great models, you know, for us to emulate at one level. Yes. Did everybody hear that? This is a good point. Once and for all, everybody's going to be good. That's right. You're going to diminish suffering for somebody. And that's worth it. Yeah. And I think that points to a real problem, I think, among workers, human rights workers and things like that. You know, to the degree that you're attached to and invested in the idea or the view that people shouldn't behave this way. It's really going to be hard. You burn out. You get very crispy. Yeah. Yeah, please. No. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. It's a good, this is great. This will serve you well. This kind of reflection. Just knowing that there's a difference between acting from the head and acting from the heart. And we're so habituated to our ideas about the way we should be or what's good and what's right. And, that doesn't have, it's not without value. There's a role that plays, but it's for us to discover for ourselves the heartfelt reality. And, that's a whole nother matter, isn't it? To say this is skillful. You know, I think people should behave this way is one thing. To actually enter the skillful conduct is something else altogether. You know, one of the things I've been looking at one of my training, some of my history is in government and politics and what have you. So I do get a little trapped sometimes in the jargon and the back and forth between the different polarities, and it's getting so ridiculously polarized now. You can really see what the attachment to the view does and how no work is getting done. You know, there's no diplomacy. There's no ability to maturely sit and discuss matters, you know, that we're just locked into views. So that can cause us to suffer a lot. But then, one of the things that I found helpful in my own contemplation is just to remember that I'm getting that information from a media that's doing the same thing. And so, I don't know that I can fully trust it. And what I know about human beings is that we sensationalize harm. And it's largely coming from the fact that we don't get dukkha. You know, so if you don't get dukkha, then when it happens, you're going to pounce on it. You know? And so that's what's driving a lot of this. And I have to know. And, I don't think I just speculate that, we're not hearing the whole picture, that for every, political figure who's digging in their heels this way or that way, there are a lot who are working very hard not to do that, you know, and we don't hear about them because it's not entertainment, you know, it's not entertaining and interesting. I don't mean to pontificate. These are just my sense of things and my own practice, but, it just seems like the difference between, news and entertainment has gotten a little fuzzy. But that's not the knowing we're talking about. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's not the kind of, I was just trying to figure out a way to say it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think, this may clarify. I don't know the Buddhist teachings, invite us to consider the possibility that there isn't any, that the idea of right and wrong is a view, no matter how we assign that, no matter what we're talking about, that there isn't any right and wrong. He's not concerned with things at that level. What he's concerned with is what is and whether there's harm or not being done from it. So even when we talk about right, the Eightfold Path and right conduct and all like that, right to effort, right concentration, right livelihood, all of that, the word that's used there as right is not something that pits right against what's wrong. It's a word that it has more of a sense of being aligned or something like that. If you're behaving in this way, you'll get to the end of freedom. I mean, you'll get to the end of suffering. You'll get to freedom and get to the end of suffering. So in that sense, it's more like it's a direct way. It's a way that'll, help you get there. But it's not, saying it's the right way to be. It's not saying it's right and something else is wrong. Although those words are used, it's more of a translation problem than anything else, you know? So I think this has been very helpful to me, is to really get to realize that it's constantly bringing us to what is happening, what is the reality. Meeting that and meeting that in the right, in the proper way, in a way that doesn't go into view about that, is the way that you'll get free. Do you know what I mean? I mean, it's a fine distinction, but it's very, very helpful. What is what we have to deal with, not what we think is the right way. Yeah. That's right. That's great. Well said. Because if we don't stay there, then that is where the view to what is happening from the vantage point of self arises, and all the sense of having to do something about it. Having, you know, something needs to be done. It's wild, isn't it? And I have to fix myself. I have to clean up my act. What can I do to stop being so hateful? And it's fascinating because it's like, yeah, even in Buddhist practice, there's practices that you can pick up that will help to free, of that state. But the baseline is, receiving the fact that that's there without, the overlay of making it wrong. It's tricky, isn't it? It's subtle stuff, you know? You have to, it takes, I mean, for me, I would say quite a number of years before you start to, oh, I get it. I'm starting to feel that, what he's saying here. He's not playing with words. It's subtle stuff, but, and you can get tongue-tied sometimes trying to explain it or watching it. Yeah. Yeah. That's right. That's right. And that doesn't mean there's not things that you can do. If you have if you're habituated to anger or hostility, you know, then, doing things like getting yourself out of the conditions that give rise to it, doing things like really, up in the ante on your samadhi, really trying to cultivate a calm, internal environment. If these states are going to arise, give yourself a prayer when they do arise by, cultivating kindness or, cultivating samadhi, you know, and trying to, actively open the heart to it. You know, that, it's not like you don't do anything. You do something, but, it's not in the old way. It's not in the way that smacks yourself around, makes the condition wrong, and tries to get rid of it. Then you're still in the soup. And you're actually doing the very thing that's going to ensure you're going to stay in that state. You know, hating the state ensures its return. Yeah. Oh, sorry. I thought you had your hand up. No, okay, good. Yes, and what were you? Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Where's your practice? Well, no, you were trying to skillfully address it, it sounds like, you know, not necessarily solve it, but, I mean, it's not, yeah, I think you're right. It's not a teaching moment. You know, the Buddha gave very specific, qualities that have to be present for you to offer something. And one of them is the receptivity of the questioner, you know. So, you know, it's not wise to do it. But I think it sounds like you did great. I mean, then there's the practical side of that. So what do you do as a group? Do you have daycare? Do you, tell people that they can't? I mean, it's not a child's activity. Maybe a little bit older. Maybe I'd say maybe 8 or 9. Yeah, but not 5. 5 is a little hard. But they should go to the, you should go to the monasteries. It's like, la, 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 la. You know, the monasteries are treated like, the temples for the, like they are in Thailand, and they're social centers. So they come and offer the meal, and the kids go all scream and run around. And we there was a Thai man at the end of one of the retreats at IMS, who was very interesting in the closing circle. He said, I've been a Buddhist all my life. And, to me, he said, I've learned more about Buddhism on this retreat than I ever learned on anything. To me, it was about going to the monastery, running around and screaming, you know? You don't want to leave them out, but find a, you know, until maybe if, when the community gets big enough, you'll have a, like, just like any, like a church would have a Sunday school program or something like that. But in the meantime, that sounds like you did very nicely to me. Oh yeah, she was suffering because, I mean, we've all done it, didn't we? This shouldn't be happening. This shouldn't be happening. People shouldn't be doing this. You know, they should be aware. They should be, somebody should have told them. Somebody needs to get up and tell them. How many times have you sat and stewed and stuff like that? And well, let's be honest. We've all done it, right? And she was stuck in that. Let's hope she had a few minutes of seeing it. Pretty much so. What do you think? Yeah. If you're focusing on the first three, then the fourth comes together. And if you're practicing in the right way, if you're looking at mind states without some semblance of non-attachment, then you will see the five hindrances, how they rise, what makes them rise, how to keep them at bay. You know, that's in the fourth foundation of mindfulness. You know, you'll see the five aggregates, what happens when you grab, what happens when you let go. You know, you'll see dukkha, you know, you'll see the skillful states and what it's like when they arise. So in a way, the fourth kind of takes care of itself. It's not that you can't work on it directly, but if you're practicing with the first three, that's the setup. Yeah. You know, I was saying the Buddha's a master manipulator. It's like, you know, whether you realize it or not, he's setting you up to see clearly. Yeah. I kind of like that about him. Yeah. Yeah. This came up in the group, and so what, everybody wasn't in on it. But one of the things that I learned at the monasteries is that when you know, have you ever had a persnickety mind state? You know, a kind of one that you just can't get a handle on. Maybe you're upset with somebody, and they are, no matter what happens, every time they come to your mind, you hate them, and they're wrong, and this is it, and something needs to be done. And all of that, and we can ruminate and get stuck in these ruts of aversion and hatred and things like this. I mean, the mind will actually go looking for, the person so you can hate them. You know, it'll do that. It's fascinating. So, every now and then one of these comes up and they're really, really strong. And, I mean, they're all strong, but some just won't, you just can't get the perspective on it. And so, what can do is, I'd like to do it in sort of a ritualistic way. Sit at your shrine, if you have a shrine at home. Light a candle, burn some incense, put some flowers, make it all a nice setting, basically invoking this, mind state, this mood or mind state. And, some people get afraid, well, aren't I going to indulge a state? Isn't that bad karma? And if you're invoking something and you're doing it deliberately to look at it, you're not indulging it. You know, you're observing it. You're trying to know it. You're trying to get some insight into it. So just clear that out of the way at the get-go. And then to invoke it, you have to really go to a very specific exchange. It can't be a rumination or an idea, it has to be something like, well, okay, he came around the corner and he looked at me and he said dot, dot, dot. And when that happened, I went, right? What's that? That's what you want to know. You want to take that thing that arises in you and take it to the cushion and, invite acknowledgement and also a more precise, seeing of what it is. And usually it'll go, you'll go through several layers. Sometimes you can't get at it. You have to say that. Some of these things are very deeply entrenched and very painful, and the mind does not want to go into it, you know. But usually you can, and it might take 10 or 15 or 20 minutes to try to work through some of the layers of it. And usually the first layer, so you just say, okay, so yeah, tell me about it. What's that? And the first layer will have this kind of quality to it. You know, well, you know, and so you listen, like you would listen to somebody who's in pain. You know, they shouldn't be that way. And they always act like they're right. And it, you know, really, it's really affecting everybody at work or whatever. All the chatter that's bubbling up in the mind, that is the articulation of the harm or the pain, right? And just listen. He's saying, yeah, okay, well, good. Well, tell me more. You know, how does that make you feel? Or something like that. You can actually create a kind of a dialogue. You start with the mind state, but you got to get to the feeling that's driving the mind state. What is it that is so painful about this? And if you are open-hearted and inquire from that, vantage point, then, you can usually nail it, you know, because you're right there with it. You're saying yes, 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 yes. Every layer that you go through, yes, yes. Tell me, speak to me. And the main concern is don't be too quick to think you know what it is. Well, I'm pissed off, and then that's it. You know, that's not it. There's something much deeper going on here, and just take it to the point where that mood or mind state tells you what it is. And it's very hard, it can be hard to do in that the mind keeps slipping off of it. When we're in pain, when something is difficult like this, why the mind keeps slipping off of it is it's trying to get rid of that pain. And so it goes into all the stories. That's all what the papancha is. It's just trying to get rid of the pain of that, of that interaction or whatever's happening here. And so you've got to keep offsetting that tendency. And that's where mindfulness of the breath can be very, very helpful because you're training the mind through that. You're not trying to get good at watching the breath. You're training the mind to stay with what's actually happening. And so every time it runs off, you bring it back. And it'll start thinking about other things, and you try to give rise to the feeling again. I'll go over here, give rise to the feeling again, and try to feel it and get a very clear sense from within it what it is. And all manner of things can come out. You can come up against a view that you're holding that is the basis of it. You didn't see the view, you know. Like I gave the example yesterday of one where the core of it for me was I really thought I was right. And he was wrong. And when I touched that, it just made me laugh. I thought, who knew? You little booger. You really think you're right. You think you're right. That's why you're suffering so much. You know, or it can be, something, having to do with not liking the uncertainty of something, not liking the fact that you don't have control of something, you know. It can be views. A lot of what's at the core of these are views that were formed in our youth or in previous lifetimes, you know, you don't even see, let alone challenge their validity, you know. One of the things that I've come up against a lot talking to people is a lot of us, at least around my age, who were raised in this time when the child-rearing technique was to leave them in the crib and let them cry. You know, and I can't tell you how many people I've come up against who have a view that you shouldn't ask for what you want. You know, that you won't get it, or what you have to do to get it isn't worth it. And, you know, I don't know about you, but that feels like crib stuff to me, you know. Or it could be a previous life, but, you know, it's just these things get in there before, a lot of them are pre-verbal. So you may not even have be able to articulate what the thing is. You may just be able to feel it. You may not even have a name. But it's great. I mean, this is great stuff to really uncover something. Especially, it's not something I do routinely. It's more when you notice that, you know, God, I'm really out of control here. I have no idea why I can't, what's going on here. I'm really deeply entrenched in a pattern that can be really good. And sometimes, if you're lucky, and it's happened a couple of times with me, if you can get to the bottom of it, to the core of it, if you will, the core misperception or delusion, it's like hitting the mother lode. And there's a lot of little extraneous perspectives that are like tributaries from that incorrect perception that they just disintegrate. You'll notice them gone in future interactions. So, okay? Yeah. Papancha is the proliferation, mental proliferation. One more. We're down time for more. Around impermanence. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, there's also suttas where the Buddha gives you sort of things that have been made into chants. Like, the big one for impermanence is, I am of the nature to age. I have not gone. I am of the nature to age. I have not gone beyond aging. I'm of the nature to sicken. I have not gone beyond sickness. I'm of the nature to die. I have not gone beyond dying. All that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise. Will become separated from me. Yeah. I am the owner of my karma, heir to my karma, born of my karma, abide supported by my karma. Whatever karma I do for good or for ill, of that I will be there. It's called the five recollections. Recollections. You can find it on the internet. Google five recollections. You'll find it. The Google's great for Buddhism. So time to do some walking, and this being our last walk, I'd just like to encourage you to walk like you've never walked before. Be mindful of walking like you've never been before.